In the first part of the talk, what I want to do is I want to talk about social networks, because we hear a lot about social networks these days, and we haven't really, most of us, had a real background in what social networks are and where the ideas behind them came from. Then I'm going to talk about mobiles, and then what I want to do in the third part is bring these two strands together so we can understand where the mobile phone is probably, and probably very profitably, going. So what are social networks? This is, as I said, this is a very hot topic. As you all know, not that many months ago, MySpace, a social network, was sold to News Corporation for almost $1 billion, over $1 billion Australian. And we think, okay, well, social networks are sort of websites, and you get your friends and you connect to them. And that's not what a social network is. A social network is something that's much purer, it's much older, it's much cleaner than that. And it comes from one basic fact. Human beings are inherently social. From the moment that you emerge from the womb, you start interacting with other people. You start interacting as a social being with other people. And a lot of the brain, for a lot of its development, is given over to modeling and understanding social interactions. Now, the interesting thing is, what scientists are starting to understand is that in boys, it sort of peters off around 11 or 12, and we're sort of done. And for girls, it goes on pretty intensively until about age 16, and this is one reason why all girls are so miserable as they enter high school. It's because what's going on here is that girls are mastering in depth social relationships that guys just kind of basically are dimly aware of, all right? But this is, you know, if you could think of the film Heathers as a really good example of what happens to women as they start to explore the depth of their social relationships. And women get cliquey, and they have all these sorts of internecine wars and all these things. But this is a part of them growing into being social beings. And women have a depth of social experience that is, for the most part, completely lost on men. But whether or not you are a woman, it doesn't matter, because in some sense, men and women are exactly alike in the fact that both sexes can hold within their brains roughly the same number of people in their social networks. And what that means is that you've actually almost got a miniaturized version of that person in your head. You're actually able to think about and model the behavior of that person. And we've learned that from understanding autistics, because one of the things that happens in certain kinds of autistics is they lose the ability to model the behavior of other people. But with people who are normally functional, we actually contain all of these little mental models of all of these people in our brain. And we have these, what are called, first-order relations. And the first-order relations take up a lot of space in your brain, and your brain is only so big. So there's a natural limit to the number of these people that you can have mental models of in your brain, because there it is, your brain's a fixed size. And there's been a lot of research in this, in anthropology, because it comes down to understanding how big tribes get before tribes break apart. Because if you have a hunter-gatherer culture, there's an optimum size for your tribe, and if your tribe gets bigger than that, it generally breaks into two or three, or there's a war or whatever. And so anthropologists started to understand that for human beings, there's something of a natural limit, and that limit, natural limit is known as the Dunbar number. So for human beings, the Dunbar number is around 150. So that's it. Within a plus or minus a couple, for every single human being on Earth, the number of little people you have running around in your head is going to be about 150. And the interesting thing is that that is very strongly correlated to the amount of material we have in our frontal cortex. Now, the frontal cortex is the thing that we got that the chimpanzees, they kind of don't. The chimpanzees are almost exactly like us, but they have an extra gene. And what does that gene do? That gene gives them really, really strong jaw muscles. The other thing that it does is it makes it really, really hard for the skull to grow. And so the reason that we have bigger heads than chimpanzees do, even though we're almost exactly genetically identical, is because they have stronger jaws. Well, we have bigger craniums, therefore we have bigger forebrains, therefore we get the great big dot on the chart. But chimpanzees, Chimpanzees don't have quite the same amount of brain size as we do. And so the maximum Dunbar number for chimpanzees is 30. And this correlates really well to the average size of a chimpanzee troop. It's just how many people, how many chimpanzees they can hold on their heads at the same time. So here's the thing. Social networks are a feature of biology. They are not a feature of technology. This is a very important point because really we have all these social networks out there and they're saying they're social networks, but I've just showed you what social networks are, and those social networks don't look anything like the social networks that News Corporation's talking about. So what do they mean when they're talking about social networks? All right, well, let's take a look at what they mean. Well, the archetypal social network was something known as Friendster, and it was followed somewhat later by MySpace. In March 2003, I started getting a lot of emails from two of my friend Karen Marcello and another one of my friends, saying, you have to join this service called Friendster, it's really cool. And I completely ignored this spam because I figured it's someone in San Francisco trying to get their web startup off the ground, and I really just couldn't care. And I ignored the mail, and I ignored the mail, and I went off to Australia, and I came back from Australia, and there's more mail coming in, and I finally answer one of the mails, and I end up joining Friendster. And the only word I can describe for the experience is web crack. All right. For a week, I was glued to the computer with this sort of vague-eyed expression and sallow and kind of sweaty, trying to find more people to link in as first-degree contacts in my Friendster profile. Because, you know, Friendster, you create this little profile for yourself, and then you go out and find all these friends of yours, and then you link to them and link to them and link to them and link to them. And it's a search because your friends aren't immediately linked to your other friends, so you have to dig around to find your friends. And so it's a bit of a game, and the reward for that game is getting another node in your network. And of course, getting another node in your network means you're more important, right? So after a week's worth of time, I had 102 first-degree connections in my network, which was pretty good. And I was very satisfied, and then I was bored and almost never used Friendster. But the interesting thing about Friendster, of course, is that it manages to embody the idea of the 6 degrees of separation, that we're separated by other people through intermediate connections. And Friendster actually made this explicit. It brought it forward so that it can show you, however tenuously, how you're connected to other people. So you might have, at maximum, if all of your friends and family were on Friendster, you'd have about 150 first-degree contacts. And keep that in mind, because you occasionally see profiles on LinkedIn or on Orkut or on Friendster or on MySpace where people have more than 150 friends. No. All right. Everyone wants to be Esther Dyson's friend or Steve Jurvetson's friend, absolutely, because they're important people. But they aren't actually friends. They're acquaintances. That's fine. But it's not, does not mean the same thing. Now, with Friendster, I could have 100 first-degree contacts. I did. And then I think if you count out the number of second-degree contacts, it was around 3,500. And then if you went out to my third-degree contacts, so that's a friend of a friend of a friend, you got out to close to 1 million contacts. And a fellow at Berkeley mapped out in some very nice visualization software what his Friendster cloud looked like. And there it is. Now, this is the interesting point. This is the thing that makes a digital social network an important thing, and the thing that starts to differentiate it from the social network that we're carrying around in our gray matter. We cannot carry around the sensitivity to 1 million connections in our heads because we'd need brains the size of this room. Well, but Friendster can do it. And Friendster is actually really good at making these connections quite explicit. But Friendster is languishing online. It's been looking for a buyer for a while, longer than MySpace was looking for a buyer. The same time that MySpace was sold, Friendster was on the market for, oh, I don't know, like $200 million. And then it was $50 million, and now I'm pretty sure it's whatever you can pay to take it away. And it's interesting because they've mastered this idea of 1 million connections to me. But what are they doing with it? Nothing. They're not doing anything with this idea that I have an implicit relationship with a million people. Okay, Mark, what would you do with it? Well, I gave this some thought last year, and something immediately jumped up and hit me in the face. What I would do with it is I would make a spam filter out of it. It's not the only thing that you need in a spam filter, but if I can check a piece of unsolicited email against my first, second, and third degree contacts, I have a pretty good chance of being able to filter wheat from the chaff. It's not the only thing you need, but it is something that you definitely need, and it's something that Google should be providing via Orkut, its own social network. It's something that Friendster should be providing. It's something that LinkedIn should be providing, but none of them are offering this service as a way to generate revenue or as a way to start to harness the innate power of this third degree explicit social network that they've created. And I'm confused by this. I've written about this, I've published about this, the idea is out there now. They still aren't doing it, so I'm not quite sure what business they think they're in. I'm not sure that they know what business they think they're in. It's very, very strange. Now, in terms of success stories, the other side of the scale is MySpace. There's been a wee bit of investigative reporting going on about MySpace. I don't know if any of you have read it. MySpace was founded by an LA concern of direct email marketers. They're a spam company. And they figured that if they could create something that would get a lot of people to dump all of their personal information into it freely, absolutely generously dumping their personal information into it, then they'd have a really good mechanism for being able to direct market email to all of these people. And that in the end, what they would have created in this social networking site would have been a license to print money. It almost worked out that way, except MySpace grew explosively. It grew very, very quickly. It grew very, very fast. And it grew very, very fast. There's my MySpace page. It grew very, very fast, so fast that it immediately attracted the interest of Rupert Murdoch, who was looking to start making investments in this space and was sold for $750 million US, which is about, at the time, $10 a user, or at least $10 per registered account on MySpace. News does not yet have an idea of how to make money off of MySpace. You've probably read that in the trade papers. They still don't understand what to do with the latent power of the network they've got. They are starting to offer advertising on MySpace. And it's interesting because they're now the second most visited site on the entire internet. They cannot use normal ad buying schemes because they so flood the market with available opportunities that it simply causes the price of ads to crash. That's how big they are. And they still don't understand that they have 85 million, I think is the number when I took this screenshot this morning, 85 million people sort of all there and waiting. They haven't figured out what to do with them. There's vague talk of MySpace blog, MySpace on mobile phones, MySpace this, MySpace that. There's vague talk of them. And then you have the president of Fox Entertainment reported in the New York Times as saying, well, MySpace isn't media. We don't really understand it. Now, to me, that means that Fox has got some learning to do, because to me this is the medium, and this is the medium because people are the medium on it. And the reason that MySpace took off, the reason it went from zero to 85 million in basically record time, is because it was colonized by its users. I point to a quote from one of the most famous current Vancouverans, William Gibson, The street finds its own use for things, uses its makers never intended. And the first users of MySpace became very adept at going in and hacking the HTML in MySpace and doing all sorts of ugly things with it to customize their pages and to put media on their pages. And pretty soon, what happened was MySpace became a configurable media distribution system. And it became a really good way to distribute your music to people. So, you know, if you're a struggling band in the universe, you have a page on MySpace. This is well known about MySpace, is that it's a space where people are constantly providing music for people to listen to, find out about bands, all sorts of things. And it's a good idea, and if 10% of the entire internet population were logging onto MySpace regularly, this would be a really great way for bands to promote themselves. In fact, the number of people who are logging onto MySpace with any regularity is probably 5 to 10 million. 5 to 10 million out of 750 million is not bad, particularly if they're in your demographic. But it's not really what we're talking about. It's not really what people are already doing. It's another way to do it. And what I want to do now is talk about what a real social network does when a real social network wants to distribute media. Now, this is what we're told is social distribution of media by a social network. It is not. What a real social network does is a little bit different. So, your average day, you either wake up and check your email or you go into the office and check your email. Okay? And there's some email from folks around the office, maybe one or two from the family, depending. And then there are the links from friends. And I mean that literally, the links from friends, because more and more of our email content is now simply watch this and a URL, or listen to this and a URL, or there's an enclosed image. All right? That's become the de facto form of media distribution for all of us in the electric era. What happens is we are all engaged in searching for cool, hip, funny things. When we find them, we entertain ourselves for a minute. And then the next thing we think is that, well, my mother wouldn't want to see this. It's kind of crude. But Kate would want to see it. It's kind of funny. And then you type in an email address, and off it goes. I call this the three F's. What we're all doing naturally as part of our online life, as social beings with these social networks upstairs, are we're finding things, we're filtering them, and we're forwarding them. All right? That's the basic operating principle for media distribution in the 21st century. We have still not seen any tool, whether it's a digital social network such as MySpace or an email client, actually get behind that to make that easier. All right? Now, YouTube, interestingly, has gone from zero to a gazillion in terms of number of bytes downloaded per minute, because the thing that they optimized all of YouTube for was being able to get something that you liked out to a list of your friends very quickly. So before I had breakfast this morning, I had already virally sent the video out to half a dozen people. But MySpace doesn't do that, because MySpace is not actually about distributing media, even though it's a media distribution network. It's about bringing you to a page and having you look at ads. Now, one thing that you'll notice immediately with Friendster and immediately with MySpace is that if you're at all using them, they become huge time sucks. Because first you spend time building your profile, and then you spend time linking to your friends, and then you constantly, constantly, constantly have to keep it updated. Because digital social networks are like sharks. If they stop moving, they die. They have to eat information constantly. But digital social networks require that you sit and feed them. It's like a tame shark, and you have to feed it a little chum every once in a while. And if that chum is relevant, then your profile will continue to grow. And obviously, 15-year-olds have time to feed chum to sharks. But for the rest of us, who has time? So for me, even though it would be nice for me to have a functioning social network and a presence there, I don't have the time for it, because the entire mechanism is just ass backward. And when I say that, I mean, you have to go and feed MySpace or feed Friendster or feed LinkedIn all this information. Now, consider Google. If Google stopped crawling the web every single second, it would no longer be relevant and people would stop using it, all right? So Google is proactive in its gathering of information. So it stays relevant, so it's a shark that knows how to keep moving. On the other hand, the digital social networks that we see in the world are like dead sharks in the water because they have to be hand-fed. It doesn't have to be that way. Okay, so now let's get down to talking about mobile phones. We do not normally, except sort of via humor, focus on the fact that mobile phones have become completely ubiquitous. We might worry a little bit about the fact that we're all going to get brain cancer and genetic deformations, but we don't actually recognize how they have radically transformed human interaction. Now, mobile phones came late to the United States. You're all aware of that. I'm not quite sure what the rollout cycle was, but I think they came to Canada a few years earlier in the curve than they came to the United States. I mean, we had them in the United States. They were invented in the United States. People simply didn't use them. The reasons for this are still poorly understood. It may have to do with the fact that we had a very good wired infrastructure. It may have been the carriers which is still rolling them out. No one really knows, all right? But I make my first trip to Australia in 1997, and 1997 was a pivotal year for Australia because it was a year that mobile phones reached 50% penetration in the population in Australia. And I get together with some friends that I had in Sydney in Darling Harbour. There's a nice picture of Darling Harbour. It was a chilly August evening, and it's a gang of friends who are all going to go out and get food. And I meet at the designated place because someone has called me on the landline and said, you need to be at such and such a place at such and such a time. And I'm there at such and such a place and such a time. And some of my other friends are there, and some of the other friends aren't. Now, in the before time, you would have had two choices. You would have sat and waited for them, or you just would have gone on without them. But this is not what's happening on this evening in Darling Harbour. Instead, SMS messages start flying around. And all of a sudden I realize, because the penny drops, that what's happening here is that the mobile phones are keeping everyone in perfect synchronization, even though they're at vast distances. The interesting thing about the mobile phone is that suddenly no one is truly late anymore. All right, because you can always call or text. And we know how frustrating it is to be stuck somewhere and to be late and to not be able to call or text, because it can really only be interpreted by the other party as the ultimate rudeness, and you have to make enormous amends. And it feels to you as if you're being blocked from this natural expression. So the only metaphor we can use for this quality of mobile phones, and the thing that we haven't really sort of cottoned on to yet, is that mobile phones are the social hormone. All right? Hormones do all the broad translating of signals around the body. And the mobile phone does this for groups of people. It allows the broad coordination of groups of people. Now consider, the flash mob is completely unthinkable before the mobile phone, and it's completely inevitable after the mobile phone. The mobile phone coordinates and it accelerates. It takes all of the social relationships we have, professional or casual, familial, and like adrenaline or testosterone or insulin and estrogen, it regulates them. Now, of course, there's been some talk that the space of the mobile phone is completely colonized by the carriers. And that's somewhat true in the context of the network that the phones are connected to. And of course, they get a lot of profits from all this hormone-related activity. So the interesting thing is that as we all got sort of amplified and more tightly coordinated and found the phones more and more useful and they became more and more part of our lives, this generated an enormous amount of energy to be more social with them. And we looked at the carrier and said, well, the carriers sort of got that cornered. But we have all this energy around them, so where should we be pouring all of this energy? And apparently the first place that this energy went was into this idea of mobile media. And you know, you can play Tetris on your telephone, you can play 3D tennis on my telephone, my mobile phone does about as good at 3D graphics as my computer did back in 1997 or 1998. I can watch a full-length movie on my phone. I can listen to several hours of music on my phone. And we have a new generation of phones using DVB-H that will allow you to pick up specialized television broadcasts. It's all, you know, it's all interesting, I guess, and it's all amusing, I guess, and there's a lot of heat around this, but what's really interesting is what Nolan said this morning, is that the game space hasn't really exploded the way everyone was expecting, and I think I know why. If you were to drop your mobile in the toilet, okay, your first thought is, I just spent $700 on that. Okay? But your second thought is not, shoot, I can't finish that game of Tetris. Or, I can't watch the Oilers tonight. That's not what you're thinking. Okay? What you're thinking is, my God, I've just lost all of my friends. That's what you're thinking. So, once again, let's step back and say, okay, what is the street telling us about the phone, about what we're using the phone for, what we need to be thinking about using the phone for? Now, of course, the biggest success in the history of mobile telephony is the unexpected success of the short message service, SMS, right? The carriers introduced it as an emergency feature, so you could tell a large number of people something that they needed to know in a hurry. And then they actually allowed the handsets to start using this feature, and all of a sudden, it became the dominant feature. Now, not again, for reasons that astound me, in North America, except for kids maybe under 15, but in all of the rest of the world that I've been to, everyone SMSs about 10 times more than they use voice. And it's even interesting that the idea of SMS has started to affect how people in the developing world use the mobile phone. Just the idea of SMS. I'm going to tell you a story. I was talking to a fellow who is a South Indian living in Australia now. And he had just been to Mumbai. And he says, Mark, really, with the exception of the very poorest Indians, everyone has a mobile phone now. It's quite outstanding. And there are carriers who are having amazing price wars. So you can get call time for like 1 or 2 cents a minute, send SMSs for 1 cent a minute. But if you're in this very poor, but not absolutely poor range of Indians, that's still too much money. So the Indians have perfected the system of missed call SMS, all right? When you get somewhere, you'll send someone a call, they won't answer, it'll be a missed call, it'll let you know they got there. I mean, people have done this for a long time, right? But you can actually get fancier than that if I send you 2 calls, and then, you know, you can send one back, and the whole thing. So they're actually taking the idea of using the mobile network as a messaging network, and then leveraging it in a way that doesn't actually require them to spend any money on it. But because the network is there and because the model of SMS allows them to understand that messages can be transmitted across that network, and because the phones are smart enough that they remember their missed calls, we have this entire emergent culture in Mumbai of lost messages. And the interesting thing about that is that we're so social and we're so busy being social that we are currently taking any medium that's being put toward us and we're hijacking it for messages. And at the other end of the scale, in affluent, urbane, technologically sophisticated Japan, we're seeing a new kind of emergence. Now, has any of you read this book? Okay, this is an MIT Press book. You should read this book. If you know who Joey Ito is, he's a rather famous pundit, internet era in Japan. This is Joey Ito's sister. Joey Ito's sister is brighter than Joey Ito, which is saying something. And in this book, Mitsuko Ito identifies a new phenomenon. Actually, kind of an old phenomenon, but it's got a technological base now. The phenomenon she identifies is something that she calls co-presence. It turns out that in the teenage communities of Japan, in Tokyo anyway, kids will wake up in the morning and they will start sending SMSs to a group of four or five friends. They're nothing particular, they're nothing with a particular aim in mind, there's just a gentle rain of them from the moment they wake up in the morning to the moment they go to sleep at night. All right? It's really just reminding each other that they're there. It's just creating the cloud of companionship that we would associate with any normal human community, only they've now extended that capability in through the device. So they can live on other sides of Tokyo, they could live on other sides of Japan, we can live on other sides of the world and do it with this phenomenon of co-presence. And that's all happening despite the fact that managing even a single SMS conversation on a mobile phone is really hard, because the interfaces on the mobile phones present an SMS as if it erupted from the void without really any context for this in the context of a thread conversation that might be going on, much less managing five conversations that are going on more or less simultaneously all day long. The Japanese kids are onto something. They've figured out what they want from this cloud of community around them, and they're perverting the handset until it gives them that sort of connectivity. And it's funny because I saw a commercial in America for a new service that's being offered where you can have a voice call with five of your best friends simultaneously, which tells me that they're kind of missing the point, because the kinds of interactions that you're having with voice versus SMS are different. SMS is asynchronous, it's in the background, it's non-interruptive. Voice is forward, it's absolutely demanding of your attention. And so it kind of tells me that the carriers themselves, even when they're starting to think about multi-person services, aren't really getting the nature of the phone as this thing that's sort of sitting there mediating an entire world of social relationships, but doing so gently in the background. Of course, to a carrier, it's all about ARPU, average revenue per user. But to the user, not just in Japan on the street, but to each of you in your seats, and how many of you walked in here without a mobile telephone? Woohoo! Okay, so was there one person? You'll have to leave, sir. You're throwing off my average. All right. So, to the street, the only thing that matters is co-presence. That's it. All right? It's not... There's nothing in the formula of co-presence. Nothing that talks about MP3s or live television. All right? In relation to co-presence, media is completely unimportant. It's absolutely secondary. And this is the dangerous thing about people who are investing themselves entirely in creating mobile entertainment. Because I'm pretty certain that while there's a market for it, and there will continue to be a market for it, it is not the main event. Now, entertainment, if you want to be in the entertainment industry, that's fine, but it's going to be dwarfed by social co-presence, all right? The entertainment industry and the telecommunication industry have both been around for about 100 years. The telecommunication industry is an order of magnitude larger than the entertainment industry. Do you think that's going to change? No. In fact, it's going to accelerate, because as we understand the nature of the mobile as a social device, more and more of the energy will go into that. And this is why we need to remember something that was a truism when it was uttered a decade ago. People are still the killer app. All right? And let me paraphrase the genius Canadian Marshall McLuhan: people are the medium and people are the message. And you can either get in front of this trend and try to develop things that make it easier to have some sense of co-presence when people are using a mobile, or you'll be swept aside by it. And in some sense, it doesn't matter what the carriers try to do. Like, the carriers are trying to slow down the adoption of Wi-Fi and mobile phones because it takes away from their revenue. Ha! Good luck with that. All right? Because it's not what the user wants. It's not what the street wants. And the street always, always gets what it wants. Trust me. Ask the music industry that. Trust me. All right? But if we take a more relaxed approach, if we listen to the street, and the name of my consultancy, Future Street, that's what it's supposed to be a pun on, we might actually learn how we could do some genetic engineering with this social hormone and figure out how to change its effectiveness inside of the body politic. And so now we'll come full circle and we'll start talking about what it means when you bring a social network together with a mobile phone. Alrighty. So, we haven't actually seen, at least in a commercial sense, there have been a few small sort of university projects, and I'll talk about my own in this section. We haven't really seen any commercial projects outside of one that I'm about to talk about that take a look at the mobile phone as an inherently social device, even though, as we've explored, that's exactly what it is. One of the reasons why is because all of the oxygen in the particular room of mobile development is being sucked out by entertainment companies right now, because everyone thinks that that's where the money is, so that's where the glitz is, that's where the buzz is, and that's where the professionals are going. And that's weird. I'm not complaining about it because it's created a space where I can actually do some interesting stuff and where I think a lot of you could do interesting stuff, because you're sort of crawling around at the feet of giants right now as they're lumbering about trying to figure out what this space is. But a tiny company, which was gobbled up by Google last year, created a little application called Dodgeball. Now, how many of you have used Dodgeball? How many of you know what Dodgeball is first? So a fair number of you. So Dodgeball is a mobile-based social network. And you fill out a profile, you link to your friends, and then you can, via SMS, register into the service and tell the service where you are, and then via that, it will tell your friends, and if you're proximal, it'll send messages around, and it allows people to coordinate, and you can even get a blind date out of it, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, all right? And that's fine, and this will become a lot more interesting when the phone has GPS in it, as the current third generation phones all do, and Dodgeball is just sort of sitting there ticking around in the background, which I'll come to presently, and it's just constantly sort of telling Google or Dodgeball or whomever where you are and sort of managing it that way. But Dodgeball is not perfect, and we shouldn't say that it is perfect. It seems to be most highly optimized for 22-year-old frat boys on a night out for fun in New York City. It's really, really, really good at that. All right? But again, like any social network, it has this one defining feature that you have to feed it and feed it and feed it information. And it's not really very good at filtering the information that comes at you. I was talking to someone yesterday about the South by Southwest Festival, and there were 300 people milling around in a huge sort of clump, a swarm, at South by Southwest, who were all using Dodgeball, and it became impossible to figure out which messages were meaningful and which messages were not meaningful through this system, because apparently, even though they've created the social network, they aren't actually using the social network they've created to figure out which messages should have priority, which means they've gathered all this data and then they're ignoring it. Interesting. Okay? But it's an attempt anyway. What Google's going to do with this is anyone's guess, right? Who knows? This may just be something that tickled their fancy for an afternoon. It may be the platform for the next generation of Google Local Mobile. We don't know yet. All right. Now, on that subject of feeding and feeding and feeding your social networks, I developed, this is my very first phone application, I developed this about 2 years ago, something called Live Record. And it was meant to be something that would allow you to feed your social network your likes and dislikes very, very quickly, because all of the profile pages on all the social networks have what's your favorite movies, what's your favorite CDs, what's your favorite TV.